Hey, everybody, it's Tuesday somewhere, and we hope to see you listening to the Giant Bombcast. We're independent games media, and you can find us hooligans every Tuesday discussing the newest video game releases or whatever we're currently into.
We also discuss all the biggest stories in the world of games. Collectively, we have decades of experience covering the biggest companies and sneaky little indie darlings, but we also have years of experience being a cool hang. The Giant Bombcast is like listening to your friends goof and gab about the games and stories that matter to them and you.
Giant Bombcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
The British royal family, crowns on the outside, chaos on the inside. On the podcast Palace Intrigue, we cover the stories behind the headlines every day with a dozen new episodes every week. Meghan and the controversy that never quits, William and Kate quietly waiting for their turn on the throne, and former Prince Andrew, well, always a story unto himself. It's smart, it's sharp, and a little snarky. It's Palace Intrigue. And when you're ready to go deeper into the royal verse, we have King William, a speculative fiction podcast. Think The Crown, but set in the future. And another series, Crown and Controversy, the stories that continue where TV's The Crown ended. Join us for daily royal news with context, clarity, and just a hint of mischief. Palace Intrigue, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster!
Conquered!
I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me!
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat!
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No. I have been begging him for a job on every platform I can, and I want to know the reason why he won't hire me.
What a weekend. Here in New York City, the Knicks won their first NBA championship since 1973, albeit on the road in San Antonio, but it was madness all over the city last night, not to mention the World Cup game over at MetLife Stadium between Brazil and Morocco, and then today is the Puerto Rican Day Parade. I hear Damian Priest is supposed to be making an appearance. I think he's I don't want to say he's been there every year, but I know he's made appearances during the parade before. So if you are attending, maybe you'll see him. I'm getting a little case of the FOMO. I'm feeling left out here. I actually heard that it's actually quite fun. I wish I could attend, but we have other business to tend to here. Seriously though, congrats to all the Knicks fans out there. I am very happy for you. I know all about long-suffering New York franchises, and maybe somebody wants to pay the $250 to Danhausen to have him record a cameo uncursing the Mets. But honestly, I don't think even Danhausen is powerful enough to reverse that curse. Some things are just beyond his scope. You know, Brian Alvarez is saying that the Danhausen Knicks stuff is currently being put together by TKO. And WWE cameras are going to be at the parade. I believe they're having a parade on Thursday for the Knicks. And so they're going to have cameras there. They're probably going to put together a Knicks and Danhausen documentary for YouTube. And he says at least one New York Knick is confirmed for Saturday night's main event next month. And they're trying to get several more. Also the coach, trying to get him there. WWE has already launched, if you didn't see, because they've been plugging it on their social media, Knicks and Danhausen championship merch on WWE Shop. And Danhausen is also going to be on ESPN either today or Monday, it looks like. So they're trying to capitalize on this. And you know what? Good for them. That's what they need to do. This is the way to do it. You know, when he shows up at MSG next month, I'm expecting a stone cold level reaction for Danhausen. And you know, NXT has its deadline show coming up in San Antonio in December. Maybe they can get him on there too. He'll get mega heat. This is episode 967 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, June 14th, 2026. I am the Solo Monster. Who else would it be? You know, it was 20 years ago this week, June 17th, 2006, to be exact. I attended my first Ring of Honor show live, which happened to be their final show that they ever did at the Grand Ballroom at the New Yorker Hotel. The New Yorker Hotel literally is around the corner to where they moved, which was the Manhattan Center. They went to the Grand Ballroom at the Manhattan Center. That's where WWE used to host Monday Night Raw in the early days. Those first episodes in 1993 of Monday Night Raw were in the Manhattan Center, all the way up on what I believe is the 8th floor in the Grand Ballroom. And then eventually, with Ring of Honor, they graduated to the Hammerstein Ballroom, which is in the same building, but right downstairs on the main level when you first enter. And so the New Yorker Hotel, literally right around the corner. This was my first show. I had never been to a Ring of Honor show before. I had seen some Ring of Honor stuff. I had heard a lot of good things about being there. They're doing these shows in New York City. It's like, how could I not go? So my brother and I, we got tickets and we went. And I had a blast. And I remember a lot about this show. I remember the first match on that show. So the first ROH match live I ever saw, I had Jay and Mark Briscoe taking on Jason Blade. Now, I had to look his name up because I couldn't remember who he was. But Jason Blade teamed up with Sterling James Keenan, who's a little busy these days calling Monday Night Raw next to Michael Cole and calling AAA. Prince Nana was there. He was managing Jimmy Rave at the time. And Jimmy Rave was just a great heel. And the Grand Ballroom had this giant chandelier over the ring. And the gimmick with Jimmy on all these shows was then, or back then, was that people would throw toilet paper at him. And so I imagine hotel management was not too happy about all that toilet paper getting wrapped around the chandelier. We actually knocked pieces of it down into the ring. But it's a damn shame that Jimmy, you know, went out the way he did at the end of his life. He had gotten an infection in his arm first. He had to have his arm amputated. And then, I don't know how many months later it was. It was only months later. He got MRSA. And he needed both of his legs amputated. So all he had left was his right arm. And then he died, I think, 2 months later. So it's very sad how his life came to an end. But for a period of time there, Jimmy Rave was one of the more, I would say, accomplished, entertaining heels on the independent wrestling scene. And I know he had a run also in TNA. I don't think that lasted too long. But then we had this match on the show here, BJ Whitmer and Jimmy Jacobs. And they hit the scariest finish that I have ever seen live. Even to this day, any live event that I've ever been to, this has to be up there as the scariest finish. And you have Whitmer on the top rope, power bombing him, an avalanche power bomb from the ring into the crowd. He power bombs Jimmy Jacobs over the barricade into the crowd. And they had a bunch of planted fans there, but that doesn't make it any less scary, like in the moment as you're watching it. An inch or two this way or that way, and that could have ended up catastrophically bad, right? But that's sort of the story of pro wrestling, right? An inch or two can make the difference between making the highlight reels or winding up in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. But that was a wild... I don't remember anything else about the match except that finish. You know who else was in action on that show? The current general manager of Monday Night Raw, Adam Pearce. He was wrestling Claudio Castagnoli. Very cool to see the two of them still doing their thing on TV in 2026. And they had an excellent three-way in the main event with Bryan Danielson, who was the world champion at the time, but I don't think his title was on the line in the match. I don't believe it was a title match. It couldn't be because Kenta won. But it was Danielson, Kenta, and Samoa Joe. How's that for a three-way main event? Bryan Danielson, Samoa Joe, and Kenta. I will never forget Danielson doing a dive out into the crowd onto, like a flip dive, out onto Joe and Kenta. It was right in front of me. I've got a couple of great photos. I can post them up on my X account on Wednesday, since that's the anniversary. But Kenta got his title match a few months later at Glory by Honor 5 Night 2, which I was also there for. One of the greatest main events I've ever seen live. And we even got a Bruno Sammartino appearance that night. He came to the ring to cut a promo with the entire... If it wasn't the entire roster, it was most of the roster surrounding the ring outside. Just watching and listening and hanging on to every word that this man was saying. I'm glad I was there to see it. And Bruno's out there. He's saying, you know, I don't want to take up too much of your time because I know you've got a lot of great matches coming up. Like, as if anybody wanted to see him rushed out of the ring. You know, like if you leave the Manhattan Center and literally walk to the corner, Madison Square Garden is right there. Like, it's right across the street. The place that Bruno sold out more than any other pro wrestler in history. I mean, he could have spoken for 30 minutes if he wanted to. I don't think anybody would have complained. But yeah, I got a lot of great memories from those early ROH days. Again, when I started going, 2006, 2007, 2008, Homicide's title win. And I mean, I can go on and on about it, but it hit me that this week was the anniversary, the 20-year anniversary of that first show that I went to. So I just had to talk about it. I had to say something about it. Maybe some of you were even at some of those shows, so you know what I'm talking about. Just the energy and the vibe back then. It's not the same now, but man, back then it was something special. My thanks to everybody who dropped a PayPal dono this week. I appreciate it. If you'd like to do so, thesolomonster@gmail.com is the place to go. You'll see the link. It's right there for you at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Paul, thank you very much. Big B, Bryant Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Q, the Destroyer. For life, brother. Big time Boris Vainman, Raj Must-See Makwana, Killshot Keith Hart, and the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert. Am I going to see you guys this Friday? Am I going to see you and Mama Eichert on Friday? I hope so, because House of Glory presents Inferno this Friday at Logan Square Auditorium in Chicago. And for the first time ever, bang bang, Ricky Sosa in his HOG debut, he steps into the ring with the Amazing Red. That is going to be fucking unbelievable. Nick Nemeth was just announced for the show, the man who will be challenging to be possibly the next TNA World Heavyweight Champion at Slammiversary in just a few weeks. And with all the rumors swirling about Mike Santana and his contract possibly coming up next month in TNA, if he is leaving, they're going to have to get that belt off of him. Very, very possible that Nemeth could be walking out of Slammiversary as the new champion. But first, he's making his HOG return, and he's going to be stepping into the ring to take on Charles Mason for the HOG World Championship. Maybe he wants to go for some double gold. Mustafa Ali, speaking of TNA, he's going to be putting his TNA International Championship on the line against Rich Swann. Shotzi, putting her HOG Women's title on the line against Steph DeLander. And we got a bunch of other matches planned as well. Limited tickets, very limited tickets, still available, hogwrestling.net. I will see you guys, some of you anyway, in Chicago. And if you can't be there live, Triller TV is where you can stream the event. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. I'm going to hit you with a true or false question. True or false? Incognito mode in your browser makes you invisible on the internet. That would be false. You'd be surprised how many people have no idea their browsing history can still be monitored and even recorded. Unless, of course, you're using ExpressVPN. Everyone should be using ExpressVPN, because without it, these third parties can see every website you visit. That goes for your internet service provider, your employer, your school, your parents. You don't want that. ExpressVPN reroutes 100% of your traffic through secure encrypted servers, so third parties can't see your browsing history. ExpressVPN is the best VPN for a lot of reasons. It's why I chose them. For one, they hide your IP address, making it extremely difficult for prying eyes to track your online activity. It also works across all your devices, including your phone, laptop, tablet, smart TV, and it's super easy to use, which makes it very convenient. Just fire up the app, tap one button, and you're protected. I'm going to be in Chicago next week for the next House of Glory show, and you can bet that I'm going to have ExpressVPN active on all my devices at the airport, the hotel, and the venue. I have enough to worry about without having to stress out over my personal data. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster to find out how you can get up to 4 extra months. expressvpn.com/solomonster. Vince McMahon's legal peril. Let's start there, at least in a public setting, is now down to one. That would be the Ring Boys lawsuit, which has him as one of the many defendants. And that one is likely to end up the way that all the other ones have, or will. Last week, let's back up a little bit here, came the news of the WWE shareholder lawsuit trial being canceled. It was scheduled to start last Monday, June 8th. And just a few days before, it was pulled from the calendar and canceled because the two sides were And I believe they still are in the process of reaching a settlement agreement in principle. I don't know if a formal settlement has been approved or reached yet, but if not, it seems like we're well on our way to that. So not a done deal just yet, and we're still waiting to find out about what that's going to look like, how much money the shareholders will actually get out of it. They were seeking as much as $950 million or so in damages, plus interest accrued, after alleging that the fix was in with the WWE sale to Endeavor 3 years ago, and that McMahon steered the outcome to his pal, his boy, Ari Emanuel, with the idea that he would be able to maintain some level of power in WWE. And he would have. He absolutely would have, were it not for the Janelle Grant sex trafficking lawsuit that dropped like an atomic bomb in January of 2024. And it started really with the Wall Street Journal story in 2022. I have some news on that here in a little bit. But the Wall Street Journal story and news of all the non-disclosure agreements with various women and performers over the years, including one $7.5 million NDA with a female talent whose name has never been revealed. But these things, they don't happen, not in these numbers, unless this man is doing something that he should not be doing. And there are still people making excuses for this toxic sludge of a human being. Says a lot about them. But it was that story that led to him initially stepping aside until he decided to force his way back in. Then this lawsuit dropped, and it was the Janelle Grant suit, and it was very disturbing, right? They had a relationship. He got her a job in the company that she wasn't qualified for. She worked her way up the ranks in short order. And according to her, he basically used her as his personal sex toy and pimped her out to John Laurinaitis, who cheated on his then wife, who was being treated for a brain tumor. These are the men who held positions of power in WWE at that time. You know, we can complain about how soulless the product feels these days and high ticket prices and bad booking and bad creative and boring television. That's a far cry from sexual misconduct and some of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes at that time for years. Laurinaitis didn't even deny it. He just tried to pass himself off as a victim. The fucking troll that he is. And Vince stopped paying her. That's, he was supposed to pay her a certain amount of money. He stopped paying what he had promised per the NDA that was signed. And that's what led to her filing suit. And doesn't make her claims any less true, by the way. I mean, the fact that she filed a lawsuit because he stopped paying doesn't make them any less true or false or anything. Those are two completely independent things. And it was always going to be an uphill climb for this woman to beat the big bad billion-dollar chairman in court, who has a hell of a lot more money to burn than she does. But she wanted to see this go to trial. That's what she kept saying. She wants it to go to trial. She doesn't want to go into private arbitration. That's what Vince was arguing for per the terms of the $3 million NDA that was signed. Her position was that the NDA was signed under duress, and it should be invalidated so that this could go to trial and everything could be out in the open and in the public forum, right? This is not a criminal case. So even if it was a criminal case, Vince has friends in very high places, okay? Birds of a feather flock together. This was never going to go anywhere anyway. But this is a civil case. So the worst that could have happened to him and could still happen to him is that he would be on the hook for a lot of money that he would have to pay her. She wanted a trial. He argued for arbitration, and the judge in the case was supposed to have made a decision this month about which one it would be. That was going to be the single most important decision in this trial. What does the judge decide? Does she have a valid argument to invalidate the NDA and we go to trial? Or does this go to private arbitration and nobody ever hears about this ever again? On Thursday, that all changed. Post Wrestling reported that the plaintiff and the defendant, so Janelle Grant, Vince McMahon, and WWE, filed a joint motion in the U.S. District Court for the District of Connecticut, requesting to continue their litigation in private arbitration, which is a big 180 from what Janelle Grant had been asking the court for. And on Friday, Judge Sarah F. Russell granted the party's joint motion. The judge is now requiring them to file a joint status report by July 10th. And if they have not reached an agreement by that date, they will have a hearing in August. And Brandon Thurston says he interprets the word agreement here as referring to the conditions of moving into arbitration, not necessarily reaching a settlement of the entire thing. The one-paragraph filing states that the parties are in active discussions regarding a potential agreement to arbitrate the dispute in confidential arbitration, which would render the defendant's motion to compel arbitration moot. The filing does not explain a reason for Grant's change in position regarding her willingness to take her dispute into a private forum. An attorney for Grant did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The parties had been scheduled to attend a hearing on June 16th, that's this Tuesday, to argue the issue as well as whether Grant would be allowed to obtain evidence from the defendants in support of her litigation of the arbitration question. So this is not a settlement, not yet anyway. This just means that they are taking this, very likely, into a private setting with an arbitrator, and they are not going to go through a public trial and all the drama that comes with that. It all started when Vince reneged from what he had promised to pay her. He paid out $1 million of the $3 million that her NDA stipulated. If he had done that, if he would have just continued to pay what he was supposed to pay, we wouldn't even be talking about this right now. Once he stopped payment, she sued him. And she claimed that she had no intention of settling and that this resignation from WWE, that this so-called resignation, which turned out to not really be all that genuine, but then he came back and then he sort of resigned again. But his resignation from WWE was not enough for her. She wanted justice. What changed all of a sudden? We don't know. I don't know what her financial arrangement is with her lawyers, but from what I remember reading, the firm that represents her typically takes these kinds of cases on a contingent fee basis, meaning they only get paid if they win the case or if they reach a settlement. Then they take a percentage of those funds. If she were to lose this case, she could walk away with nothing. And even if she doesn't have legal fees to pay off, and she very well might, she may be broke at this point for all we know. But I imagine that her lawyers would probably not be too thrilled about that if she lost and walked away with nothing. So for Vince and WWE, a trial would prove to be very embarrassing, right? That's the reason he fought so hard against it. It's disappointing. It's disappointing because, again, where there's rot to be found, I think it should be exposed for all the world to see, right? In as public a setting as possible. And if there are people who deserve to be dragged, then they should be dragged. She's had a change of heart. That's her decision, right? It is what it is. But it is disappointing that she has suddenly had a 180 on this whole thing. What's concerning is that if this thing is that much closer to being wrapped up, that makes it more likely that we see Vince McMahon back in WWE at some point. Remember, Ari Emanuel had no issue with Vince McMahon being there, even after all the Wall Street Journal stuff came out in 2022. Right, this was a big Wall Street Journal bombshell story, and then there were subsequent stories. Right, his reputation was already tarnished. Didn't stop Ari from having an issue with Vince. Why he wanted him there? It was contingent. The deal, according to Ari Emanuel on CNBC, was contingent on Vince being a part of it. Now maybe he was playing 3D chess and really did not want him there, but he had to pretend that he did to get him to sell the company to him. Right, we're going to find out, because the entire reason they got rid of him in the first place or asked him to step down was because of this lawsuit. And if this lawsuit suddenly goes away, that means the one real obstacle to his return goes away. And I put nothing past these people, right? Bruce is still there. I always liked what Ronda Rousey said, right? So long as Bruce Pritchard is there, Vince McMahon has an in, because Bruce is basically Vince's avatar, right? Once this all comes to an end, anything is possible. I'm not saying he's going to be back in charge of creative. I'm just saying anything is possible. And that is a scary thought. Even scarier that there are people out there, fans and ex-talents alike, who want him to come back, who think that he's the only one who can make the product great again. Yes, the 80-year-old octogenarian sex pest is the only man who can restore WWE to its former glory, its past creative glory. If you honestly believe that, then WWE is doomed. If you think he is the only savior for this company, they're doomed. Teddy Long did an interview with TMZ's Inside the Ring podcast this week, and he talked about the state of wrestling today. I want to read you just a portion of what Teddy had to say here, even though it will make you dumber for having heard it, but I'll read this anyway. He said, a lot of talent is out there now. Some guys are doing great, some guys are not. And it's based on the creative people, the people that are in charge of what you do out on that TV. That's how your career is based. You can go out there and do something one night and it will kill you. That's kill your whole career. And they know how to do that to people. A lot of guys that are in charge don't do it because you can do the job. They'll mess with you because they got the power. They know they can. So it's changing a little bit now, but I think what we got to do, we got to get Vince back so we can do this thing right and get the fans back on board. Oh my God. And on the possibility of Vince returning to wrestling, he said this. I don't think the chapter has ever closed with him. Like I said, I don't know what happened or any of that stuff, but in my knowing him, wrestling was his life. He loved this. This was his life. I had a chance to ride on the plane with him one night, and as soon as we took off, he talked about wrestling until we landed. And so he loves this. This is his life. I watched him at his 80th birthday party during the rehearsal. They had a band and some singers there, a choir, and they were rehearsing before they got ready to go. I saw him, and he had his headset on, and Kevin Dunn was there. Kevin has always been his right-hand man. He's looking at Kevin and saying, Kevin, get him over there. You know what I mean? He's doing his thing. He's at home. I looked at him and I'm like, this is him. This is what he does. You know, I can understand being transactional. Like, this person always treated me well, so therefore they're okay in my book. They're willing to overlook certain things because of that. His argument being, though, I don't know what happened or any of that stuff, is not a valid argument, right? Ignorance is not a valid argument. Just because Vince McMahon did right by Teddy Long does not mean that it's okay for him to be back in a position of power over other people. But this is who we're dealing with here. Now, he also said in this interview with TMZ, this is, again, Teddy Long says, I went to Vince's birthday. After the birthday party, Vince gave me this bust of his head. I have that. We could go see it right now because I have it in the room over there. No, he didn't give them out to everyone, but I'm not the only one that got one. I would consider that as my prized possession. Vince McMahon giving a bust of his head to someone is that person's most cherished possession in the world. Sounds like that's not the only thing that Teddy's been busting when it comes to Vince McMahon. Today's episode is sponsored by ZocDoc. I'm going to level with you, okay? I've put off doctor's appointments before because I just didn't want to get hit with the inevitable tests and bills that follow. It's just such a pain. But as you get older, you realize how important it is to stay on top of your health. The longer you put it off, the more it's going to cost you later on anyway. Better to see a doctor now and make sure nothing is wrong with you than doom scroll on your phone or self-diagnose on some of these websites. This year, we're doing things a little differently. We're finding doctors we love, and we're making appointments with ZocDoc. ZocDoc is a free app and website that helps you find and book high-quality in-network doctors so you can find someone you love. That's in-network appointments with more than 150,000 providers across all 50 states. Whether you're looking for a dentist or a dermatologist, ZocDoc makes it easy to search by specialty or symptoms to build the right care team that makes sense for you. Want to see your doctor in person? Go for it. Or maybe you'd prefer a video chat. You can make that happen too. View thousands of verified patient reviews to give you a sense of who your doctor really is, so you can feel confident that you're booking with one that's going to meet your needs. You'll see their availability in real time, and you can book instantly with one click. And appointments made through ZocDoc happen fast, typically within 24 to 72 hours of booking. You could even score same-day appointments. That's like hitting the lottery. I've found some great doctors through ZocDoc in the past, and I'm very lucky that right now I have some great ones at the moment, but if I had a need for ZocDoc right now, you can bet that that would be the first place that I'd be looking. ZocDoc helps take the guessing out of things, and it makes what can sometimes be a stressful process totally stress-free. Stop putting off those doctor's appointments and go to ZocDoc.com/Solomonster to find and instantly book a doctor you love today. That's ZocDoc.com/Solomonster. ZocDoc.com/Solomonster. Thanks, ZocDoc, for sponsoring this message. But then you have JBL, who never met a boot that he didn't enjoy licking. The same guy who said ESPN should be giving WWE A-letter grades in their reviews, even if they don't actually believe they deserve them. So he chimed in on his podcast, or technically it's not even his podcast, it's Bruce Pritchard's podcast. But he chimed in the other day. I saw this. He was responding to news of the shareholders' lawsuit heading towards a settlement. He said, "I don't know what the settlement was. My dad used to always tell me a bad settlement is better than a good lawsuit any day of the week. And sometimes, you know, I've been around Vince a long time. Vince just gets out of things." Does he now? Do tell us more, John. He said, "Sometimes it's not worth the trouble. These lawsuits, sometimes they're fishing. Sometimes there's some merit behind them. I don't know the veracity of any of the claims. I don't know the merit of the lawsuit itself." I want you to remember him saying that, okay? "I don't know the merit of the lawsuit itself. But getting out of this is a really good thing for TKO. Ron," talking about Ron Simmons, "and I used to joke that we would sue the company for $1 billion and settle for $100,000 just to pay off a house. That's essentially what these lawyers are doing. They're saying this company is worth so much money. Let's file a lawsuit, tie them up in court, and see if we can get lucky with a settlement. That's all these jackasses are doing. There are so many lawyers who tie things up in the corporate world. That certainly appears to be what this is. I just don't see any merit to it whatsoever. I hope these guys didn't get any money because this is such bullshit. I've seen Vince over the years pay people off when he felt there was no cause whatsoever just to get rid of them. I'm not talking about anything serious, maybe a dispute over a building or something, just a nuisance. It's a nuisance fee." So, Tariq, and by the way, in the abstract, what he is saying is not untrue, right? There are a lot of shyster lawyers out there who will do that sort of thing. But I would like to recap very quickly for you that in this one quote, he goes from trying to pretend being the key word, to be unbiased by admitting, "Well, you know, I don't know about the veracity of the claims or the merits of the lawsuit itself. I just don't know." To a minute later, saying that he sees no merit in it whatsoever and calling it all bullshit. You know, like, I get some of the wrestlers from that era having brain damage, all the chair shots to the head they took, right, over a period of many years. It's understandable. I mean, you could throw him in there too. But what's Teddy's excuse? What don't they understand about this? Like, this man became a liability to his own company, to where when they had acquired the company, TKO Endeavor, they had to put fine print in their SEC documents talking about what a liability Vince McMahon was to this company. All these people who pray for the return of Vince McMahon, it's like they forgot all the years of slop that he spoon-fed us. That, or they're stuck at a time warp and they still think it's the Attitude Era. This man is 80 years old. His best days were behind him 10 years ago. We do not need Vince McMahon back. If TKO ever wanted to replace Paul Levesque, or if you think his creative vision is too boring and safe, I don't disagree with you. But bringing back the old man, that is not the answer. But I do think it's inevitable that he is going to pop back up at some point in some capacity. This paves the way for that. It just feels like it's only a matter of time once he gets this settled, once and for all. The Ring Boy suit, the past bad press, none of that's going to matter to TKO. The only thing that could hold them back from doing stuff with Vince McMahon again would be if the sponsors spoke up. If the sponsors started to pull out, if the backlash, let's say on social media, was so fierce, you know, that they tag sponsors and do all these things, that's the only thing that they would care about. That's the only thing that would matter to TKO. If there was some sort of sponsor backlash. And once this disappears from the public eye or it gets settled, I doubt very seriously that any of them are going to care. Now, interestingly, on her Instagram page that she opened a few months ago, Janelle Grant posted a screenshot from a transcript of a deposition. There was deposition testimony given by Michelle McKenna, who was a former member of the WWE Board of Directors, where McKenna stated that she believes that Nick Khan was the person who leaked those anonymous emails to the Wall Street Journal, which is what put the whole series of events in motion that ultimately led to the Endeavor purchase and the formation of TKO. Now, that is just one person's opinion, but that she would say that under oath in a deposition, there must have been something about him that would make her think that there was at least a decent possibility that it was him. But we may never know for sure who leaked those emails. On the Coach and Bro show over on Jonathan Coachman's YouTube channel, Vince Russo let it slip the other day that Conan has undergone a double leg amputation. Now, it was first reported back in March that Conan was in the hospital due to complications from, I want to say, diabetes, and had one of his legs amputated, but evidently he had the other one amputated as well, which is terrible. He spoke with Conan the other day, Russo said, but he said he was very weak. He was going through some grueling rehab. Russo said that in their conversation, Conan revealed that WWE has paid every cent of his medical bills, and good on them for doing so. You know, we're probably talking about medical bills in the millions of dollars at this point, not thousands, you know, for something like that. A double amputation and for him being in the hospital for months on end, not even counting medications. You know, when people have some catastrophic accident or they get sick and they need to be treated, it's always a worry, like, how much is this going to cost me? Because even with insurance, like, it could end up bankrupting you. So, like, now instead of worrying about getting better, you're sick and you're stressed about, like, how am I going to pay for this, right? And stress kills. It's bad enough to be sick and in the hospital and probably stressful enough, but you add more stress on top of that, stress is a killer. Bad enough to go through something like that to begin with. You shouldn't have to also worry about how or if you're going to be able to pay for all of it. So if WWE is stepping in to help him out on that, I think that's nice to hear. He's not completely divorced from them, of course. I mean, Conan does work for AAA, which WWE acquired last year. So he does work for them, but it's not as if he suffered an accident on the job, right? Or in the ring. They're not exactly obligated to do that. But best wishes to Conan. I don't know what kind of influence he has there anymore creatively with AAA. Undertaker seems to be getting all the credit and all the love, although I do think people need to start putting some respect on Jeremy Borash's name as well. Conan's had health issues for years. He had a kidney transplant many years ago. He needed another one. I don't know if he ever got it, but I know as of a few years ago, it was reported that he would need another one. So this is just another in a very long line of issues that he's had. CM Punk has been missing from WWE television since the Raw after WrestleMania, after he lost the World Heavyweight Championship in that great Night 2 main event against Roman Reigns. And then after Mania, he told us, you know, I'm not going to sit around sulking over it. I'm not going to go on vacation. Right? He was going to stay ready. Evidently, that meant off television because we have not seen him since. Outside of those gym photos with him looking all yoked, there was video too. There was like a little video clip as well. A lot of people have been talking about CM Punk, speculating about him on, you know, social media. He's on steroids because of, you know, a few low resolution photos that made him look bigger than he really is. Oh, he must be on the gas now. He's a body guy, right? Then this week, a rando account on X posted what they claimed was a scoop, saying Punk may have been playing politics behind the scenes with the WrestleMania main event and didn't get his way, and now he's upset about it, which has led to some heat backstage between him and WWE and the powers that be. But wait, he may have also been asked by TKO to take a pay cut, and he's pissed off enough over it that he may have threatened legal action or even asked for his release, which is why he's been off TV. But then they also, in the same breath, they cautioned that there's been some cold water thrown on this, namely the part about him asking for his release. See, I think the whole thing is unbelievable to begin with, just because, you know, they're talking about him threatening legal action and all this stuff, when we know full well CM Punk, you know, he would have just walked over to Triple H or Nick Khan. He would have started throwing fists. He would have lost his cool, because that's what he does. So this report is already unbelievable. You know, I would like to sit here and tell you that I'm shocked by how much traction this nonsense got on social media and how many people have taken it and ran with it as if it has any legitimacy to it whatsoever, which it doesn't. It's all bullshit. Made up, bogus, grade A factory bullshit. And I guess because there just hasn't been a lot of real hard news this week outside the Vince McMahon stuff, people are bored, and so they saw fit to create their own news cycle. Fightful Select was forced to look into this nonsense, and they report that nobody in WWE, among the dozens that Fightful spoke with, have heard that Punk wanted out of his contract, and no talent that we heard from believed he was asked to take a pay cut. One source we spoke to says that he has a story coming up soon with new merch being produced and dates planned for the summer. And so on Thursday, WrestleVotes Radio reported that one source has told them, signs point to Punk being back on TV on or before the July 6th episode of Raw, which just so happens to be taking place in Chicago. Now, this comes with a report from Dave Meltzer that Punk is expected to end up on the SmackDown roster upon his return, which is something that I have been saying since after WrestleMania, that he needs to be on SmackDown. So that would be a welcome change. And even if Raw is in Chicago, it's not like as a Raw guy, right? We haven't seen him appear on SmackDown before when they're in Chicago. He did so the night that AJ Lee made her return to the company. So that doesn't mean anything. SmackDown is where CM Punk should be. That show could use all the help that it can get. And if they get back Randy Orton and Drew McIntyre soon, or even just one of them, and Sami Zayn finally has an interesting story for himself after months of stagnation, Gunther just got moved over to SmackDown, Rhea Ripley moved over there after she won the women's title, Finn Balor just was traded over there. You know, with the influx of newer faces on the show and the show moving back to 2 hours in a couple of weeks, they have a real chance to push the reset button on that putrid show and make it watchable again.
Killers don't just take lives. They reshape everything they left behind. A quiet back road, a busy stretch of highway, a house that once felt safe, now a shrine to everything that went wrong. Across Texas, deserts, fields, and bayous keep their secrets buried, but not forever. From the creators of Gone Cold comes Of Hell, Texas True Crime, a podcast about the state's most depraved killers and the scars they left on every town, every family, every mile marker they touched. Stories that ask one burning question: were there more victims? Some folks aren't just from hell, they're of it. Of Hell, Texas True Crime. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now, Fightful also had a report that said some people within AEW have long believed that bridges between Punk and the company could eventually be rebuilt, even if he never actually wrestles there again. The report noted that Punk may not repair his relationships with everyone in AEW, but asked whether he had completely burned bridges with the promotion, the response was, never say never. And then on Friday, Jack Perry posted an image on his IG story of an album cover from the album Ape Got Fire by Front End Loader, showing a creature torching a bridge. You know, what Jungle Boy doesn't seem to realize is that if in some bizarro world CM Punk ever wanted to go back to AEW and Tony Khan found out about it, he would take him back in a heartbeat. If Jack went to Tony and said, hey, it's either him or me, right? Jack would be gone so fast, even at max speed in the Jurassic Express bus, Luchasaurus would not be able to catch up to him. Okay, that's how fast he would be gone. But this is all much ado about nothing. The fact that this was even in the news this week shows you how slow of a news week it was. I don't know if Punk disappearing from TV was always part of the plan or if it happened because creative changed suddenly, which, I mean, clearly it did with Gunther, right, being shifted over even though it looked like he was going after the world title. And then all of a sudden he's on SmackDown attacking Cody Rhodes. I think the Randy Orton injury necessitated that. It's not the worst idea to give Punk a little bit of time off, given that he's 47 years old and he's been injured multiple times. Okay, they've been very fortunate that he's been able to stay healthy recently. Giving him a couple of months off to recharge the batteries is a wise move. And then bring him back in time for SummerSlam. You know, a feud between Punk and Cody is what I want to see. Maybe it's too soon for SummerSlam. I don't think it's too soon, but whether it happens there or not, it's something that needs to be done. Cody has stagnated. A feud with Punk is just what he needs. And he did tell Cody back in April, you never know when a title opportunity might fall out of the sky. And my first thought was, you know, money in the bank, but it doesn't have to be money in the bank, right? An opportunity can fall out of the sky in a multitude of different ways. In fact, there's a tournament happening right now where the winner gets to choose the champion that they want to challenge at SummerSlam. And you might be asking yourself, Solomonster, CM Punk is not even in the King of the Ring. What are you talking about? We'll get to the King of the Ring here in a second. Where there's a will, there's a way. Don't count that out as a possibility. But let's talk about Raw and SmackDown here and some of the key stuff from this week. I mentioned Cody Rhodes. Cody Rhodes and Gunther, as you know, are going to be having their rematch very soon. In fact, next week, this coming Friday, for the WWE Championship. Because Gunther got fucked over at Clash in Italy. The referee didn't do his job well. And so, because of that, not only does Gunther get a rematch, but he was given the chance to pick the stipulation for said rematch. We found out what that would be this past Friday. Cody Rhodes will challenge Gunther for the WWE title, commercial-free, with Sami Zayn, the last real good guy, as the special guest referee. Now, this is 8 days before Night of Champions, and we know the WWE title is going to be on the line at Night of Champions because it has to be, because Roman Reigns is not flying to Riyadh, and Cody is front and center on the event poster, so he's going to be defending his championship there. The only question is against who? He's not losing the title to Gunther on Friday. I just cannot see him losing the title to Gunther on Friday. Sami Zayn being in there, they want you to believe, because the issues of late, the heat that Cody and Sami have had, they were in the ring together on Friday, the most compelling segment, by the way, on the entire show. Sami slapped him, immediately started apologizing. I'm so sorry, I didn't mean it. Forgive me, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And then Cody slapped him right back. And then Sami went and grabbed the chair. He was about to bring the chair into the ring, but he thought better of it. He dropped it and he left. Right? There's heat between these two. So they want you to think, uh-oh, right? Cody's belt is in grave jeopardy now with Sami Zayn in there as the referee. I don't know how the finish is going to go. I think it's going to go in such a way, though, where it's kind of left very ambiguous who the better man is. We're not going to get a clear-cut straight winner, I don't believe, on Friday. I do think that all roads likely lead to a triple threat at Night of Champions with Cody, Sami, and Gunther. And I think that would be a good main event for that show. That would be a match I would genuinely be looking forward to because I'm into the Cody and Sami stuff. It's kind of weird. Like, Gunther is almost an afterthought in all this. They just have not been doing anything interesting with him lately. But the Cody and Sami stuff, to me, that's been the most interesting stuff that's been going on SmackDown. To the point where, and I would not have said this a few months ago. In fact, when he wrestled and lost to Drew McIntyre at the Royal Rumble in Riyadh, Sami, to me, that was as low as he's been since even like pre-Bloodline. Just nothing interesting about him. Completely just vanilla, bland character with no real sense of direction. The idea of him being a world heavyweight champion at that moment, not interested. Couldn't see it. Here we are now 6 months later, and the script has flipped. And I feel very differently about Sami in that if they wanted to put the title on Sami at Night of Champions, if they wanted to put the title on Sami at SummerSlam, I'm on board with the idea of WWE belting up Sami Zayn, right? And again, for a brief period of time, he's not going to have the championship for very long. I think it would be a short run, but even a short run, I'm on board. If that's where this is heading, I'm okay with that. I'm actually more okay with that at this point than I would be just putting the belt on Gunther. At least Sami has an interesting story arc going on. He's a heel, kind of, but not totally, right? He's got his ride or die fans, and he's making a lot of very valid points, frankly, in these promos about Cody. Not unlike his buddy Kevin Owens when he was feuding with Cody. He was making a lot of very valid points, too, even though he was the heel in that feud. Rhea Ripley, she's the WWE Women's Champion on SmackDown. She is out with a knee injury that she suffered in Italy. It is currently being evaluated. They said a timeline for her return is going to depend upon how she responds to treatment. So the last time we saw her in the ring was against Jade Cargill at Clash in Italy. They had what I thought was a better match even than the one they had at WrestleMania. Rhea retained. After that, she worked two trios matches with Charlotte Flair and Tiffany Stratton against Fatal Influence on their European tour. I don't know how much Rhea did in those matches, but that's the last time technically that she's been in the ring. But it sounds like the injury may have happened, maybe not on the tour, but maybe it happened at Clash in Italy. But in any event, hopefully it is not too serious that it would take her out of SummerSlam or force them to have to strip her of the championship. Obviously, that would suck. It would take a major name off the table for that pay-per-view. I'm sure that's the last thing they want. But that's where things stand right now. I guess it could go either way. It's 50-50 as far as her knee goes. Now, False Finish HQ was reporting this week that JC Jane is being considered internally as a potential candidate to challenge Rhea for the championship at SummerSlam. And I'm okay with that. I mean, that's not a marquee match. JC is still very new to the main roster, but JC is a star on the rise in that division. I would have no issue with that being the match. There are bigger matches that they could do for that show that I would like to see, but if it was to be Rhea Ripley against JC Jane, I think that would be fine if that was the SmackDown title match. I mentioned Jade Cargill. Jade Cargill did not have a good night on Friday. She was part of a four-way Queen of the Ring match with Charlotte Flair, Sol Ruka, and Lyra Valkyria. And we got our first taste of the eventual singles match between Charlotte and Jade. And God bless them. I hope that by the time we get to SummerSlam or whenever that match actually happens, they go out there and they can have a great match. This was anything but on Friday. I'm watching it. I mean, I could point to specific moments and things that happened. I'll just kind of distill it down to this. I was watching them to see how they work together. And it was very clear to me, and this is a noticeable thing in a lot of Jade matches, but for whatever reason, it was just more noticeable here. I didn't notice it as much in the match with Rhea a few weeks ago. Very, very tentative, very, very deliberate, almost waiting for Charlotte, it looked like, to guide her into what they were supposed to do next. And it just, you're watching this match and it looks like they're going through the motions of a play fight, right? When you watch a wrestling match, you don't want to be actively thinking like, okay, I could see like the little thought bubble popping out of their head. What are we doing next? You know, what's the next spot? And that was the vibe I was getting from these two. It was very slow and very boring and very bad. Very bad. I hope that they can clean that up by the next time they're in the ring together, because that's a big match. That's still a big marquee match. The first ever singles match with Jade and Charlotte, right? You could do that at SummerSlam, but I hope it's a hell of a lot better than whatever the hell that was on Friday. WrestleVotes Radio is reporting that a match between Jade and Charlotte has been penciled in for SummerSlam. So where do things stand with the Queen of the Ring? Charlotte Flair was the lone SmackDown talent to pick up a win in either tournament this year. That is pathetic. That is pathetic. But Charlotte Flair moving on was the right outcome. She will now wrestle Liv Morgan on SmackDown this Friday in the semifinals. Io Sky is going to be wrestling Raquel Rodriguez. I imagine that would be taking place tomorrow night on Raw. I don't think they've said when, but let's say it happens tomorrow. So what are we looking at? We could be looking at Liv against Raquel, an all Judgment Day final, which I would rather not see. We could be looking at Io against Liv, which I would be fine with. Io against Charlotte would be even better. I'm thinking Stephanie Vaquerre returns this week to cost Liv, and then they go off to fight for the women's title at Night of Champions. Charlotte, meanwhile, and Io, they battle it out in the finals. We end up with Queen Io. That's where I'm thinking this is headed. In the King of the Ring, the SmackDown sweep was completed on Friday. The SmackDown burial was completed on Friday. Even more impressive than the Knicks sweeping the 76ers and the Cavs right out of the playoffs this year was the SmackDown sweep that we saw completed on Friday. Obafemi is going to get Dominic Mysterio on Raw tomorrow night. On the other side of the bracket, we got our first real upset on Monday, where it looked like Seth Rollins was a shoo-in to not only go to the semifinals, but to go all the way to the finals. He got bounced in the opening round against Javon Evans, Ricky Saints, and Tala Tonga, thanks to Bron Breakker and The Vision. And Javon Evans ends up the beneficiary. He is moving on to the next round. I actually like that. Maybe I should have seen it coming after Breakker failed to win his match the week before, but I was still expecting Seth to advance. So when he didn't, I was surprised. So the only thing left to decide was who would Javon Evans be facing in the next round out of Jey Uso, LA Knight, Royce Keyes, and Finn Balor. Keyes and Balor were SmackDown's last hope. That hope was extinguished when they had the Yeet Man pin LA Knight. And so Jey Uso was moving on. Not that it was going to happen anyway, but if any LA Knight fans were holding out hope for an eventual world title run, you got to give it up. It's not happening. You got to let that go. He's on the wrong side of 40, and they don't see him as world title material. That's just the way it is, and that's not going to change. But they went with the least appealing of all the available options. Jey Uso against Javon Evans is of no interest to me. Jey Uso against Obafemi in the finals is of no interest to me. Jey Uso winning the crown is of no interest to me. Jey Uso challenging Cody Rhodes for the WWE title at SummerSlam is of no interest to me. Jey Uso challenging Roman Reigns for the title at SummerSlam is of even less interest to me, based on the last match they had at SummerSlam. Jey Uso winning another world title is of no interest to me. Yet this is where we are right now. And we could very well be looking at King Yeet, because if Brock Lesnar doesn't show up on Raw tomorrow night, he is almost certainly showing up in Riyadh to screw Oba out of a win. And if it's against Jey Uso, then that means Jey wins. Now, as I see it, that's the only way Jey Uso gets to the crown. It would have to work. That path I just laid out, that's exactly how it would have to go down. If it goes down that way, then Jey wins. How awful would that be for Oba Femi to go to the finals and lose to Jey Uso, right? That would be just terrible. Now, I'm keeping hope alive that we could end up with a last-minute replacement in the tournament. I went over this idea last week. I brought it up. The idea being that you get a last-minute replacement if Javon or Dom or even Oba were to get taken out, right? Who's to say that Brock Lesnar doesn't show up tomorrow to take out Oba before the match with Dom even happens? Dominic mentioned that in an email, not Dominic Mysterio. I'm talking about Dominic from Connecticut, who sent an email in. Brock returns. Let's just lay this out. Brock returns tomorrow night, right? A surprise ambush. Maybe he breaks Oba's arm with a Kimura lock, right? So now Oba, he wants to go. He can't go. Medical will not clear him. And so Dom is, of course, he's over the moon. He thinks he's going to the finals. And Adam Pearce says, you still need to earn your spot in the finals. I'm going to find a replacement. Next week on Raw, you're going to face that person. That person ends up being, oh, I don't know, CM Punk, who beats Jey Uso then in the finals, chooses Cody to challenge, which would explain the jump from Raw to SmackDown if they do move Punk over to SmackDown, and we get Cody against Punk at SummerSlam. That's so when I mentioned before, like, you might look at Cody and Punk and say, how are they going to get there? There's not enough time. No, there is time. There is. If you wanted to do it at SummerSlam, that's how you do it. And I love that idea, right? That's the sort of thing I was getting at when I talked about getting a replacement in there last week. Whether it's Orton, McIntyre, Punk, there's a few different people that could be slotted in there who are MIA right now, but you have to imagine they're going to have a role at SummerSlam. They could still salvage this thing and give us something unpredictable, give us something fun, but like a good unpredictable. Not unpredictable for the sake of being unpredictable, but unpredictable in a good way. There's still time. And with that idea, let's say you went with the broken arm angle. It puts Oba on ice just long enough to kill time before the big SummerSlam finale with Brock Lesnar, where now Oba has a real reason to want to kill this guy. He cost him a world championship match, and he broke his arm. I like it. Yeah, the thing is, WWE does not know how to book tournaments. They generally do a very poor job of it when it comes to the main roster. The Cruiserweight Classic, the Mae Young Classic, the United Kingdom tournament many years ago, those were all great. When it comes to the main roster stuff, they don't know how to do it. They just don't know how to do it. This would at least salvage this thing and make things a lot more interesting heading into SummerSlam. We have more legal news. The Department of Justice's antitrust division has given the green light for Paramount Skydance to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery for $111 billion. This comes from Politico. The decision, announced on Friday, paves the way for Paramount to combine with the entertainment and media company behind a vast film and television studio, CNN, and the HBO Max streaming service, which would be combined with Paramount Plus, to create a new offering boasting about 200 million subscribers. The deal, which would upend the Hollywood ecosystem by combining two historic rival studios, is opposed by many in the entertainment industry who fear it could lead to mass layoffs, among other concerns. After an extensive review, DOJ officials determined the transaction did not pose a threat to competition and declined to challenge it, said the people who were granted anonymity to discuss sensitive matters. The department approved the merger without requiring any divestitures, behavioral remedies, or concessions, according to one person. In a statement, the antitrust division said its 8-month review determined, based on the evidence received in its investigation, that the transaction is not likely to result in harm to competition or American consumers. Of course not. And could ultimately increase it by creating a stronger competitor across streaming, television, and film. The department said investigators reviewed more than 2 million documents, conducted hours of depositions, and worked alongside state attorneys general before reaching their decision. Now, where this is relevant to pro wrestling, which is, again, just a very minor part of the impact that this will have, WBD is the media partner of All Elite Wrestling, right? Dynamite and Collision, they air on TBS and TNT, respectively. AEW programs and pay-per-views, they stream on HBO Max. So this is a deal that will affect their future. No doubt about it. At the end of their current deal, everything is up in the air as to whether or not their new bosses are going to want to keep pro wrestling on its properties, and if so, if they would be willing to pay Tony Khan at least what he is currently making on their existing deal, if not more. Because you would have to think that Tony is going to want an increase on their next deal. He's not going to want it to be flat. But this is also a company that's going to have an awful lot of debt to pay off. Are they going to be willing, even if you ignore any relationship that they have with TKO through UFC and Paramount Plus and all that, are they going to be willing to go all in on the sickos and dole out $600 or $700 million? Wrestling is still cheaper than a lot of other sports properties, right? And it is year round. You can't ignore that. No off season. So that makes it very attractive, but we're not going to know the answer to that question for a while yet. That's if the deal even goes through. It probably will. But I bring this up because even though the DOJ approved it, they gave it its rubber stamp of approval, and we all knew they would. We knew this thing was going to sail right through. That was never really in doubt. They still have the issue of the California State Attorney General. This guy, Rob Bonta, he says that the deal remains under investigation and he could potentially be joined by other state attorneys general in trying to block the deal. And if you don't think that they can do it, it was only a couple of months ago here in New York that the state attorney general, Letitia James, and seven other state attorneys general were able to get a court order halting another big media merger between Nexstar and Tegna. They filed a lawsuit in March to block the merger. They got a preliminary injunction preventing the merger from going through until the lawsuit is litigated. So at the very least, they could block this and they could stall it out for a while. And if they do that, and frankly, even if they don't, I mean, there's still the international hurdles that this thing has to go through with the EU and whatever. I mean, this isn't just a domestic deal. This has implications all over the globe. But where it gets interesting is if this deal doesn't close by the end of September, because they have had this very aggressive timeline where it's like, we think this deal could be done by the end of September. Like, that's a very ambitious timeline. If it doesn't get done by the end of September, Paramount has to pay an extra $627 million for every 3 months after that, every quarter that the deal does not close. It's what they call a ticking fee. It's tucked away in this deal. Now, I know these people have some deep pockets and they got some Saudi money in there and all that, but the longer this drags on, it becomes a real question as to whether it even makes financial sense to do the deal anymore. I mean, it did make financial sense before. I mean, again, you're talking about a company that has debt. Now they're going to have debt on top of debt. None of this makes any sense. I mean, you understand why they want all of these properties, but financially, I'm saying it doesn't make any sense. It's going to make even less sense, though, for every month that ticks by that this deal does not get done. And this comes from a post-wrestling story on Wednesday. AEW is now accusing Ryan Nemeth of misrepresenting and misleading conduct, and they are seeking to move the arbitration process in Nemeth's lawsuit to the state of Florida. I'm going to read you from the story here. Despite an agreement to move to arbitration last year, AEW and Ryan Nemeth remain at odds, with the promotion petitioning the court to compel Nemeth to arbitrate under the terms of his previous contract. The former AEW performer filed a complaint in February of 2025 against AEW, Tony Khan, and Phil Brooks, CM Punk, in the Superior Court of California, alleging assault, professional retaliation, and being blacklisted from the industry. He also accused AEW of breach of contract, breach of implied covenant of good faith, and fair dealing. In April, Nemeth voluntarily dismissed the suit in Los Angeles Superior Court, agreeing to take the matter to private arbitration. Therefore, AEW dismissed its own petition in the U.S. District Court of Florida, where it was seeking to compel Nemeth to private arbitration per the language of his AEW contract, where matters would be adjudicated. 1 year later, AEW says that Nemeth has misrepresented and misled them through his conduct. The wrestling company filed a petition on June 5th in the U.S. District Court in the Middle District of Florida to compel Nemeth to arbitrate the dispute at a JAMS administrative office nearest to Duval County, Florida, and be adjudicated under Florida law. JAMS is a private company designed to help resolve disputes and arbitrate. It is the company that AEW has designated in its contractual language to settle any disputes. It has 29 locations worldwide. It is based in Irvine, California. After agreeing to move to arbitration, AEW says that Nemeth filed a demand for arbitration with the JAMS office in Orange County, California, and added an assortment of unsupported claims under California Labor Code. AEW states that the California Labor Code does not apply here because Nemeth was not an employee, and he was classified as an independent contractor. AEW attempted to move the claim to Florida last November, but on December 2nd, JAMS declined. JAMS presented both sides with a list of 10 potential arbitrators, with six located in California, three in Florida, and one in New York. The sides have the option to strike two of the options and rank the remaining ones in terms of preference. AEW argued that the number of California arbitrators favored Nemeth's as opposed to the number of options in Florida, and that arbitrating in California is in violation of the express terms of the agreement. AEW seeks to have the terms of Nemeth's contract deemed valid and enforceable, and to have Nemeth arbitrate his claims at the JAMS administrative offices nearest to Duval County. Accordingly, the arbitration would fall under Florida law. It also wants to prevent Nemeth from prosecuting an arbitration in violation of the agreement and is seeking reasonable attorney's fees and costs incurred in this proceeding and any other such relief to which the petitioners may be entitled. And in a separate filing on Tuesday of this past week, AEW and Tony Khan are seeking to seal confidential information related to the three independent contractor agreements that Nemeth signed from 2021 to 2023. They argue that the agreements contain sensitive, confidential, and proprietary information belonging to the petitioners, including but not limited to information related to its business practices, internal economic structures, compensation agreements, and intellectual property. This is the same Ryan Nemeth who tweeted about CM Punk without naming him, but it was very clear who he was tweeting about. The night that Punk returned on Collision, this was months after Brawl Out, and Punk came back. Remember, he got in the ring and he cut that promo and he made that counterfeit Bucks comment. He tweeted that Punk was literally the softest man alive, which he later claimed he tweeted as a heel. See, he was in character. He's also full of shit. He knew exactly what he was doing when he made that comment. Like it was almost like he was trying to will a match with Punk into existence. He was trying to start like a social media angle on his own to try to angle for a match with Punk, which was never going to happen because Tony Khan barely even used Ryan Nemeth at the time. The last thing he was going to be doing was working with a star like CM Punk. Not that Punk would have allowed it anyway. I mean, he would have just banned him from Collision like he was doing everybody else. But this is what led to Punk angrily confronting him backstage. He was ready to throw down, right? This was like 2 weeks after they had just brought him back and the guy's ready to throw hands. But at the time, I defended Punk in this regard. One of the things that Nemeth alleges is that he was ordered to antagonize CM Punk, who did not need a lot of antagonizing back then. I mean, the dude had a hair trigger in that company. If that's true, and there was a person or there were people behind the scenes in AEW that were using Ryan Nemeth as sort of a vehicle to poke the bear and get Punk to lash out so that maybe then they could turn around and fire him, those people should have been fired. We never found out who those people were. Again, if he's telling the truth here, we never did find out who those people were. But if that happened, those people should have been fired. Right? We can all use our imagination about who those people probably would have been. So there was never any chance of that happening. But still, that was a serious allegation that he made. I don't know if Nemeth is going to get anything out of this case, and he was hardly a major player there. But as I said at the time, there are no innocent parties in this story. Not Ryan Nemeth, not CM Punk, not Tony Khan, not anybody else. I don't think there was a single person, frankly, who came out of this whole fiasco, everybody who got roped into it, who really came out of it looking like, hey, you know what? This person got a raw deal here. Or this person is the only one who looks good out of this whole thing. Nobody looked good. Everybody looked terrible. Nemeth, by the way, took another veiled shot at Punk a few weeks ago on X after those photos surfaced of Punk looking jacked at the gym. He said, I love that straight edge guys are like, nothing is ever going in my body ever except PEDs, which I will be putting in my body actually very often now that I do steroids. But of course, that does not break my sacred vow. I am more disciplined than you. Gee, I wonder who he could be talking about there. I can't wait for Punk to show up on WWE television looking exactly the same size that he was the last time we saw him, which is exactly what I expect. Just so we could be done with this whole Punk is a body guy nonsense. This week's episode is sponsored by Wix. So you've got a little online storefront where you sell stuff. That's awesome. Nothing better than being a business owner or working for yourself. But you better make damn sure the user experience on your website is going to keep people coming back for more. That's why it's so important to have a website that people want to bookmark and continue to visit. This is where Wix's Harmony Editor comes to the rescue. Wix Harmony is an AI website builder that allows you to get your site up quickly while making sure that it stays true to your vision of what you want it to be, and it meets all of your needs. The AI component is the difference maker here, but it's not the only component. It's not the only way for you to build your site. You still have the ability to edit manually and create the look and feel that you want. Aria, your personal AI agent, is there to help answer your questions and help get important stuff done. Click anywhere on your site and ask her to make changes instead of entering prompt after prompt. And before you know it, you'll have a site up that you can be proud of. Join the more than 280 million businesses around the world that already use Wix and try Wix Harmony right now to see for yourself at wix.com/harmony. That's wix.com/harmony. Some other news and notes. We got the official schedule for Dark Side of the Ring Season 7, which kicks off on Vice TV with a double episode on Tuesday, July 7th. I don't have Vice TV, but I will find some way to watch these and resume the reviews that I've done for every season so far. The schedule is as follows. July 7th, Jeff Jarrett, parts 1 and 2. And then July 14th is going to be Jeff Jarrett, part 3. So what these are, it's not just Jeff Jarrett. It's TNA and Jeff Jarrett. They've created a three-parter. First two parts are going to air on night one, and then every week thereafter there'll be a new episode. Part 3 will be on the 14th of July. July 21st... I want to say, is Samoa Joe against Necro Butcher. They're going to have their own episode. They had this 1 9-minute match on the indies many years ago, and they're going to devote an entire 45-minute episode to this. July 28th, Big Boss Man. August 4th, Renegade Rick Wilson. August 11th, Paul Orndorff. August 18th, Missy Hyatt. And August 15th, Zach Gowen. I think of all of the ones here, the ones that I'm probably looking forward to the most in terms of my level of interest would be Big Boss Man, because I don't know what's particularly dark other than the fact that he passed away very young. I kind of see that maybe as being similar to the John Tenta episode. So I'm looking forward to that one and the Renegade one. The Renegade one is that is a Dark Side of the Ring story. The schedule, it says July 14th for the Samoa Joe Necro Butcher one as well. That has to be a typo, though, I'm thinking. Because I'm pretty sure the only week where they're doing a double episode is week one. And then week three is the 14th. That's the part three episode. But this says July 14th for Samoa Joe and Necro Butcher as well. I'll have to check on that. I'm guessing it's a typo and it's the 21st, but I don't know. Maybe they're skipping July 21st for some reason. And even more legal news. You know, I may need to get my law degree to keep up with all of this. This is a follow-up to a story I first brought to you on Sound Off 957. The head of a New York City preschool was arrested several weeks ago for embezzling nearly $3 million in tuition and blowing through thousands of dollars on WWE tickets, among other things. We now have an update from the New York Post. The former head of a German immersion preschool in Brooklyn pleaded guilty Thursday to bilking nearly $3 million in tuition payments and blowing almost all of it on luxury vacations and WWE tickets. Muriel Mizak, 43, pocketed roughly $2.8 million in tuition payments from the Kinder House in Park Slope, Brooklyn, according to a press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York. Mizak, who pleaded guilty to wire fraud, embezzled the tuition by transferring payments from unassuming parents into her personal accounts. She started the scheme in January 2022, just 2 years after she was promoted to director. The disgraced educator burned through the loot, spending more than $600,000 on food and entertainment, another $350,000 on tickets to WWE match. Well, I mean, that kind of tracks given these TKO prices. $350,000. So what is that? Three shows that she went to attend? She also wasted several hundreds of thousands more on luxury goods, food deliveries, and ride-sharing services. A law enforcement source previously told the Post that Mizak splurged on a VIP package to Monday Night Raw and met the pros with her three children. Mizak's co-workers eventually raised questions about her high-flying lifestyle, which would be impossible to maintain on her $40,000 annual salary. Yeah, apparently this dopey moron here was also posting about all of her exploits and trips on social media, which kind of tipped some people off. The director, who has dual citizenship in Switzerland, claimed that she was the heir to a wealthy Swiss family in an attempt to explain away her eyebrow-raising expenses, according to a lawsuit that the school filed against her in December. When Mizak's ploy was eventually uncovered in October of last year, the school's principal had to use her personal savings to cover payroll and operational costs. Mizak faces up to 6.5 years behind bars on top of paying $2.8 million in restitution. She could also be deported when she completes her sentence. She originally pleaded not guilty to wire fraud, money laundering, and engaging in monetary transactions in criminally derived property in late March. You know, taking out the trash, you love to see it. She should be deported. Let her serve her sentence and then kick her ass out. It's bad enough to steal from a daycare, but to spend it on WWE tickets, especially for this product. I mean, yeah, 25, 30 years ago, I could see it. But I mean, this product, are you fucking kidding me? The thing that still gets me is the $150,000 she spent on food delivery services. Like, again, that's a lot of DoorDash. She must have had their ruby gold VIP status. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Binder from Milwaukee. Today, we talk a lot about tribalism with WWE fans against AEW fans. Sometimes it seems a bit over the top with what fans think of one brand over the other. How does this compare to how fans felt about WWE and WCW during the Monday Night War era? Yeah, I got a couple of questions in the mailbag about tribalism this week. And there was also an interview that Chavo Guerrero gave, I think with Gabby AF. He was on that show. I pulled a quote from it. I just thought it was timely given I got a couple of questions about it. But this is what Chavo said about tribalism among wrestling fans. He said, "I don't understand that. Why people do that? I get that you have people who like WWE more. They may like AEW more, whatever. But wrestling's wrestling. I don't like when the fans criticize somebody else just because they don't like the brand. If it's a damn good match, I don't care if it was on TNA or New Japan or AAA. I don't care if it's an indie show. If it's a good match, it's a damn good match." And he's right to me. He's not wrong about that. I think it's weird. It's just weird and sad and pathetic when people will shit on somebody because, oh, well, they're in AEW or, you know, they went to the Fed. I hear that a lot. They went to the Fed, you know, they're done. And they talk about it in these terms, and it just makes them sound very unintelligent, frankly. As far as the tribalism is concerned, oh my God. I mean, you talk about the Monday Night War. Let me tell you something. If social media existed back then in the way that it does now, the tribalism would have been as bad, if not worse. So I don't think it's just a product of, oh, well, it's worse today. It wouldn't have been so bad. No. I guarantee you that if social media existed and you had like RSPW and message board forums, but I mean, if we were connected in the way that we're connected today, the tribalism would be every bit as bad, if not worse. It was very much the same way back then, even just amongst some of my friends, where you were either WWF or you were WCW. So that's just a small sample size. I can imagine it was like that with a lot of other people. Maybe you had friends who were the same way. They watched Raw, they didn't watch Nitro, they watched Nitro, they didn't watch Raw, they liked WWF, they hated WCW, or vice versa, whatever the case may be. I was always a WWF guy, but I didn't hate WCW. I would tune in because, frankly, there were plenty of episodes of Nitro that were a hell of a lot more exciting than what I was seeing on Monday Night Raw, and flipping back and forth was part of the fun. So I didn't hate WCW in the way that some fans would have hated WCW back then, but you definitely had people who picked a team, and they were loyal to one team over the other. And that meant that everybody else on the other side, you know, was the enemy, and it was shit, and it was, you know, this and that. So I just think the tribalism was there. It was always kind of bubbling under the surface. It just wasn't out in the open in the way that it is today, because everybody now has a voice in a way that they didn't back then. Everybody has a phone in their pocket that they can pull out at any given moment, and they can tweet, they can post whatever they want to at a moment's notice. There's breaking news, there's a jump, somebody went from this promotion to the other, whatever, you know, whatever the case may be, and everybody has to chime in on it immediately. You know, like as soon as it happens. So it would have been very different, and not in a good way. Put it that way. Kevin from Washington, D.C. How do you feel about Bubba Ray's idea for Obafemi at SummerSlam? Oba goes on to win the King of the Ring and then wrestles Lesnar on night one of SummerSlam, then Roman on night two, and he wins both nights and he wins the championship. I wouldn't hate it. I mean, Oba, I think Oba is that guy. I mean, you heard the reaction he got on television on Monday. It's fucking unbelievable. So I wouldn't hate it, but then what's the plan if Oba doesn't beat Brock on night one? Like, if you just think about it in terms of kayfabe, right, is the idea that it would be a number one contenders match? So if Brock wins, he then challenges Roman on night two? Because if not, then the idea doesn't work, right? You're leaving Roman Reigns potentially without a challenger heading into the second biggest show of the year. And also, I feel like that there's a chance that could backfire. I feel like that there are people who are really supportive of Oba, but being in Minneapolis, you know, it's Brock's hometown, his home state. You don't really know what the reaction is going to be. It's probably going to be positive. Are there going to be more people who want Brock to win because they want to see him get the title match on night two? So I don't know that I would do that, but I still think it's more likely Seth Rollins and Braun Breaker's next match ends up being kind of a de facto number one contenders match, and Rollins wins, and he still gets Roman at SummerSlam. He's out of the King of the Ring, but that does not mean that we're not going to get Roman and Seth. I think there's still a very likely possibility we will. Adrian from Dallas, I really hope Chad Gable gets an opportunity for the Intercontinental title at SummerSlam, but to me, it would make more sense for him to go after the U.S. title, given his Olympian background. I get that Gable is on Raw, but there's time for a trade or something like it. What are your thoughts? I don't think it's necessary. I mean, just because it's the United States Championship, it's like, you know, who gives a shit? Trick Williams has the belt right now. Putting Gable on there to challenge him for it, to me, doesn't make any sense. Trick's got his own thing going on right now with Carmelo Hayes and Ricky Saints, and you're giving those guys the shaft. They have nothing to fight for. If you suddenly move Gable over to SmackDown, it's forced, and it fucks over a bunch of people. I don't like that. So having him on Raw go after the IC title, I think that's the way to go. I think he's in the right place. Carlos from New York, do you think AEW would benefit from putting on a women's Continental Classic? What stops it from not working? Other than injuries, the timing. You would have to do it at a completely different point in the year. You can't run two of them at the same time. The way that they do them, you would have no time for anything else on the TV shows. So it's like, okay, when do you do it? When is the best time in the year to do it? Do you do it in the spring? Do you do it in the summer? Because you got the Owen Hart tournaments, right? And sometimes the Owen, it might start in May. Sometimes it might start in June. But the Continental Classic is in December. So you don't want to go right from that into the women's, let's say, in January or February. I don't know that the timing of it is really going to work. I'm not saying they can't do it at some point. I just think the timing would be the biggest issue that they would have to figure out. Mark is from Wittenberg, Germany. If John Moxley ever decides to go back to WWE, what name would he use? Will they keep John Moxley or would they go back to Dean Ambrose because of the legacy of that character in regards to The Shield? I think that they should keep John Moxley. It's like bringing back Zack Ryder and letting him go by Matt Cardona. I think at this point, he's more established now, more well-established as John Moxley, and I think you bring him in as Moxley, right? People would know he was part of The Shield as Dean Ambrose, but you don't have to call him Dean Ambrose. I mean, people are going to know anyway. Dan from Allentown, Pennsylvania. When I heard that Ludwig Kaiser was bailed out of jail by Gunther, first thing I thought was, this is going to end up being used at an angle somehow. So how about this? After Americano Kaiser wins the AAA mega title, Gunther shows up in AAA and threatens to take the title and the mask off of him and mentions the fact that he was the one to bail him out when he was in trouble, but Americano never showed any gratitude. I would have Gunther win the title, but just before he's able to rip off the mask, the other Americanos run in for the save. Gunther holds the title for a few months, while Americano Kaiser licks his wounds and heals his bruised ego, eventually, though, makes a triumphant return and regains the belt from Gunther. So, first of all, no, I would not do that. The idea, though, that if Kaiser is going to stay down there for the long term and play out the El Grande Americano stuff, and he's going to basically be the star babyface in AAA for, I don't want to say years to come, but for the foreseeable future. Like, I'm not opposed to Gunther at some point making a voyage down to AAA. Oh, my God. I mean, you know The Undertaker would love to book Gunther. I mean, that's his guy. That's his boy. And so maybe Gunther takes a, not a sabbatical, he takes a an excursion down to AAA for a little bit, and we get some matches with him and Kaiser under the mask. I think that could be fun. But Gunther is too big of a piece. He's too important a piece to the main roster to just send him down to AAA to work for the mega title. Like, who cares? You know what I mean? Like, again, I'm not opposed to him making an appearance at some point or wrestling Kaiser, but this is not the way to go about doing it. It would be beneath him. Yeah, there's no reason for the main roster to lose him for something like this. Not for an extended period of time. Like, you're talking about putting the belt on him and letting him run with it for a few months, and I'm not sold on that. Nick from New Jersey. For a long time, I've had this observation about the final competitors in the Royal Rumbles from the mid-2000s to the early 2010s. Back then, there were two world titles as well. I noticed in most of those Rumbles, the final or sometimes even the last two stars eliminated also competed in world title matches at that year's WrestleMania. In 2005, John Cena. 2006, both Randy Orton and Triple H. In 2007, Shawn Michaels. In 2008, Triple H. In 2009, Triple H again. In 2010, both Batista and John Cena. And then in 2012, Chris Jericho. I always assumed on why this was done was because if there was a botch and the booked winner was accidentally eliminated, the booked runner-up would be getting a world title shot at WrestleMania anyway. So no harm, no foul, as almost happened during the infamous 2005 Rumble finish. Do you know if there has been any behind-the-scenes confirmation on if this was the actual logic behind these Rumble finishes, or was this just a massive coincidence for nearly a decade? There's been no confirmation of this. I've never heard anybody, not Bruce Pritchard or anybody, talk about that. I mean, it could be a good question for someone to pose to him on his podcast. Although I know at some point, was it 08? I think it was late 2000s is when he left the company. So he was gone for several years. But like 05 to 08, I think he was still there. I mean, there may have been some logic to it. I just think it probably had more to do with the fact that, you know, they wanted it to come down to some big names. And those big names were likely to be involved in title matches anyway. at WrestleMania. When you have two championships, it was probably just a coincidence that it worked out that way. I don't think it was done where it's like, okay, if this guy accidentally gets eliminated, at least we got, you know, if Sheamus accidentally gets eliminated in 2012, well, at least Jericho's in there. Like, I don't know that that was the thought process behind it. It may have just been a coincidence, but no, I don't think it's ever been addressed publicly. It's not anything I've even ever thought about, to be honest with you, until you just brought it up. Mr. Rod from Alexander City, Alabama. I recently watched the latest MLW anthology on the Extreme Horsemen. Do you remember this group? And if so, do you have any more insight on the short-lived faction? I never heard of them before. So I got your question, and I had to look them up. Apparently, it was a takeoff on the OG Four Horsemen. I mean, obviously, the name Horseman is in there. But this group you're talking about, the Extreme Horsemen, they appeared first in... Dusty Rhodes had a promotion for a while called Turnbuckle Championship Wrestling, TCW. So apparently they appeared there first. And then later on they appeared in MLW with Justin Credible, Simon Diamond, Steve Corino, CW Anderson, and Barry Windham. And they were managed by J.J. Dillon, and I guess the Extreme Horsemen name comes from a lot of those guys being involved in the old ECW. So... that was the first I had heard of them. I had never, you know, been made familiar with them before. They were obviously a very short-lived group. They didn't last very long. And frankly, any revival of the Horsemen is going to end up being short-lived. That's why there should never again be a Four Horsemen. There should never again be an NWO. It's not going to work. It's already been done. You're not going to be able to do it better than the OG versions. So there's no point in doing it. Like, the worst thing they could have done was put the word horseman in there. They could have called them anything else. They could have called them horse shit. It still would have been better than horsemen, because you're already drawing comparisons to something that is far superior. I don't know why you would do that. Nicholas from Long Island, New York. I can't believe it's been 15 years since the pro wrestling world lost the great sweet and sour Larry Sweeney. To me, he is the greatest what-if in pro wrestling history, and I loved his work in Ring of Honor in Chikara. Do you know the reason why WWE did not sign him in 2006? I remember he appeared on Raw as a parody of Nick Hogan when Randy Orton was feuding with Hogan, but nothing ever came from it. Yes, that was the Orton Knows Best skit that they did. God, I had forgotten about that. I miss that dude. I always said, and a lot of other people have said this too, this is not like I'm the only one who has said this, but it's true. Larry Sweeney, he was the closest thing to a modern day Bobby Heenan. Like, that guy, he should have made so much money in the business. As far as why WWE didn't sign him, I just think he came along at the wrong time. You know, when he was getting popular on the indies, more so as a manager than an in-ring. I mean, he wrestled, but he was popular as a manager than an in-ring talent, I would say, although he did both. But at that time, WWE was phasing out the role of manager. Vince McMahon, oh, it's an old school thing. He didn't want managers anymore. Maybe you'd have one or two, but like the art of the wrestling manager, it was a lost art. It was being phased out. They don't have a lot of managers in WWE today either, right? But it is better now than it was 15, 20 years ago, especially in AEW. You look at AEW right now, my God, he would thrive in AEW. I mean, look at Don Callis. He's all over these shows, right? That could be Larry Sweeney today. I think he came along 10 years too soon. That's what I think. Yeah, he did an interview that year in 06. I don't remember if it was, I don't even know if High Spots was a thing back then. High Spots or RF Video, and maybe it was something else. But he said that he had not been contacted. Somebody asked him, have you been contacted by WWE or TNA? And he said, no, neither company had contacted him. He had that one, like you said, that one appearance on Raw as like an extra. And but they just weren't interested. And that's a damn shame. Because again, that's a guy who should have gone on to have a lot of fame and fortune in the business. And unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. Kennedy from Orlando, Florida. Buy, rent, or sell on these three CM Punk dream matches. CM Punk against Bret Hart, CM Punk against Randy Savage, or CM Punk against Ricky Steamboat. I got to go Punk and Savage. I got to buy on Punk and Savage. I'm going to rent on Punk and Bret, and then Punk and Steamboat. You get no bad matches in this, but I have to rank them in that order. Punk and I have that in common, by the way. Like, if you ask me who's your favorite wrestler of all time, it's Bret Hart, but it's a tough one because Macho Man is right there. Like, to me, it's Bret and Savage. Those are the two. And for Punk, clearly, Bret and Savage were his two favorites as well, so we have that in common. John from Staten Island, New York. I'm watching the King of the Ring 93 final with Bret Hart and Bam Bam Bigelow on the Vault Channel, which is one of my favorite matches, and it made me wonder, what's your favorite King of the Ring final, and what's your favorite wrestling tournament final? A man of wrestling culture, I see, is John. I watched it the same day they uploaded that match as well. They just uploaded that the other day to the Vault. Bret Hart against Bam Bam Bigelow. You know what? I would say that's still my favorite just because of the story they told that entire night, that entire pay-per-view with Bret through the first round, the semis, into the finals. He's all beat up. The fingers are all taped up. You know, Bam Bam got a bye into the final round, so he was fresh and well-rested, and he was the favorite going into it. And kudos to Jim Ross, Bobby Heenan, and Randy Savage. I know Jim Ross has said he never liked working with Randy Savage on commentary because he was just... I mean, look, Savage was not a great commentator. There was something about his commentary that I enjoyed. I cannot sit here and tell you that he was a great commentator, and I'm sure working with him maybe wasn't so easy. So I know JR never really liked working with him, but like, I thought that they made a great announce trio that night. I thought they really helped drive home that story that they were trying to convey. As a match, I cannot say that it's as good as Randy Orton against Gunther 2 years ago in Saudi. Like, even with the botched pinfall in their match that we all thought was leading somewhere, and then of course it led to nothing. That objectively, I think, just has to be the best wrestling match of all of the King of the Ring finals, is Randy Orton against Gunther. My personal favorite is still Bret against Bam Bam, but the better match is Randy Orton against Gunther. And I got to give a shout out to one more here. I got to give a shout out to Baron Corbin against Chad Gable in the finals on Raw in 2019. There's not a whole lot on Raw to praise from 2019, but those two always had good chemistry in the ring together. That was one of the better King of the Ring finals they've ever done. It really was. And they got time, too. That was like a 15-20-minute match. You know, the Chaos Theory to Corbin, that was a thing of beauty. The Tilt-A-Whirl into the End of Days. I had been waiting for them to recreate that finish since the finals of the first Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic in NXT, and they did. That's how the match ended. You could see then how good Gable was. It's very frustrating that it took another 7 years for them to realize it enough to hopefully give him a real push now. But as far as a wrestling tournament final, I mean, look, there have been a lot of great tournaments over the years. Classic ones, the Super J Cup in 1994. I really enjoyed the Cruiserweight Classic that WWE did a decade ago. There's all of those great G1 Climax tournaments. For me, I know I gushed about it on the Sound Off at the time. That 2016 G1 final, actually, forget the final, the 2016 G1 Climax is the greatest tournament that I've ever seen. That's the one that had Omega Okada 3. And I flip-flop between calling this their best match or the hour-long match, which I think was their second match, calling that their best match. At the time, though, I thought this was better than all of their previous matches. And one of the big reasons for it was the length of the match. They had to get this done in under 30 minutes. They had a time limit. So they didn't have a lot of dead time that you would expect early, like in a big Okada match where he takes his sweet time. And I just thought that that third match was fantastic. I think it was like 24 minutes or something. And that wasn't even the final. The final had Omega against Naito, which was just outstanding. I would put that match against any other tournament final that I have ever seen in any promotion. And I think the one that comes the closest, and this is where it's tough to pick one, is the finals of the men's Owen Hart tournament in AEW last year with Will Ospreay and Hangman Adam Page. Just unbelievable stuff. Like, there's a reason they closed that pay-per-view with that match, even though there was no title on the line. They went too far on the near falls. That's the one thing I did not like about that match. Too many near falls. That's a big epidemic in wrestling these days. but just a fucking awesome match. I mean, you can't go wrong with either one of those, in my opinion, as the best. You know, Ospreay Hangman from last year or the Omega Naito one from 2016. But good question. So keep emailing me to solomonster@gmail.com. Love hearing from you guys. Now, I wanted to save this for the end here real quick. I've been on a movie kick lately. I've already been to the movies this year in person more than I have in at least 15 years. And there's a bunch of other great movies coming out this year that I'm looking forward to. I saw this week on Friday, actually, before SmackDown, I went to go see Disclosure Day. Everybody was saying this is Spielberg's best in 20 years, right? Big Steven Spielberg blockbuster movie, big summer flick. It's got aliens, right? What's not to like? So I went to go see Disclosure Day. Disclosure Day was more of a disappointing day for me. Because I went into this and I really wanted to love this movie, and I barely ended up liking it. And I'm watching this movie and then it's over and I'm sitting there and I'm like, you know, I saw two indie films last month, back to back, that had a combined budget of like barely $10 million, both of which were a lot more interesting and a lot more compelling to me. And this movie here costs more than 10 times that. Think about that. The budget for this movie, to create this movie, not even including the marketing, because then it's up to like $180 million. But the budget for this movie here was more than the combined budget for Obsession and Backrooms. That's one of the problems with Hollywood now. You got all these big budget blockbusters, and some of them are great. Some of them are great. And then you watch a lot of them, though, and it's like, man, I don't think they needed to spend this much money on this. I just saw a movie the other day that was made for a hell of a lot less and was a hell of a lot better and didn't have all these big name stars in it and everything. And that's a Hollywood problem these days. But my issue with it is like this movie, it spends so much time getting to the act of disclosure. But when it's over, I'm like, this is basically just your sort of run of the mill enemy of the state. Remember Enemy of the State with Gene Hackman and Will Smith? Your typical enemy of the state type government thriller where you have one character that's escaping or running away and trying to hide somewhere. And then you do the same thing with the next character and you do it like 3, 4, 5 different times over the course of the movie. And it's just not that interesting. So like all of these, like if you saw any of the trailers, you basically saw the entire movie. Like there really is not much else to it. I will say this, I'm not going to give away any like spoilers for things that happen, but I guess this is kind of a spoiler for something that's in the movie. There is a wrestling scene in the movie. So imagine, to my surprise, I had not heard about this in advance. And I'm watching this movie and I'm like, wait a minute. There's a fucking wrestling scene in this movie. I can't get away from this shit. Then there's like, and that was cool, but like then there's another, and by the way, there's a couple of AEW guys in that match. I won't say who. But like, there's another scene in the movie. They have like this like CGI looking fox. It's just so obvious that it's CGI. To the point where I was laughing. I was kind of like giggling to myself. Like this, just, really? You could find like a real fox? This looks fucking dumb. But yeah, like it was over, and I'm like, man, that's it. I'll tell you what my other issue with the movie was, and this isn't necessarily the fault of like the movie itself. I mean, maybe in a way it kind of is, but it's kind of a victim of where we are today in the world where everything is AI in terms of like the videos that you see. You'll see clips on TikTok or IG and stuff like that, and it could be hard to discern what's real and what's not. Like there are videos that will pop up on my feed and I genuinely, like sometimes it's obvious and then other times it's like, I don't know if this is real. This is the age that we live in now. To where you can put a video up of almost anything, and I feel like nothing would shock people anymore because all they would do is be like, oh, that's got to be AI, right? Even if it's real, they would probably look at it and go, oh, that's AI. So like when they build to the big disclosure at the end of the movie and all this like, you know, confidential footage that's being released and all this other stuff, that's kind of the gist of it. I'm like, it didn't hit the way that it probably would have hit 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. Because now it's like this big revelation that's going to change the world. And I'm like, you know what? If something like this were to happen today, I feel like half the world just wouldn't even believe it. They would just chalk it up to being some fake phony AI video. So it's like, I'm sitting there going, what's the big deal? You know what I mean? It's just, that's just the product of the way the world is now, unfortunately. So I don't know. This just, it didn't work. It didn't work. And if this is supposedly Spielberg's best in 20 years, it's like a return to form for the great Steven Spielberg, right? And he is. I mean, look at his body of work. My God, you get Jaws and Jurassic Park and Schindler's List and on and on. And if this is a return to form for Steven Spielberg, then I'm sorry to say the magic is gone. E.T., this is not. Anyway. I think I gave it a star rating on my Letterboxd account. You can follow me on Letterboxd, at the Solo Monster is my handle on there. I'm seeing Toy Story this week. I'm very much looking forward to this, actually. I've never seen a bad Toy Story movie. Now, you could say, though, they should have stopped after the second one or the third one. Look, I kind of felt the same way, and then I saw the fourth one, and I said, fuck, this is a great movie. So it's like, hey, as long as they have a great concept for these movies, you know, go ahead, keep making Toy Story. It's not like they're coming out every year with a new Toy Story. I think it's been, how long has it been? 7-8 years since the last one? I know for like, at one point there was a gap of like over a decade between the two of the Toy Story movies. Like, hey, as long as they can come up with a really cool, fun concept or idea for it, it's not like the characters have to age necessarily, although I think they aged Woody in this one. I saw some still shot of Woody with a bald spot. But I'm looking forward to this. And then after that, I don't know that there's anything after that for a while. I don't think I have any movies on my watch list until the end of Oak Street, the J.J. Abrams movie in August. I don't know. I mean, they have these trailers out for The Odyssey, this big epic movie that's coming out next month on the 17th. I don't know. I'm kind of in between on that. I don't know if I should see it or not. I know they both have Anne Hathaway in it. Anne Hathaway is in The Odyssey, and then Anne Hathaway is one of the stars in the end of Oak Street. Hollywood just recycles the same actors over and over again. You ever notice that? Anyway, I'm going to be back with you next Sunday. That will be for episode 968 of The Sound Off. We will have our own disclosure of all the new wrestling news of the week next week. This week, just be aware, we have the Raw Post Show on YouTube Monday night. Tuesday, a brand new episode drops of the Uncrowned Wrestling Show. You can find that on the Ariel Helwani Show feed, wherever you get your podcast from. And then Tuesday night, a brand new episode of Tuesday Night Titans over on JD's channel. I am very happy that the Knicks wrapped up this championship last night, because otherwise Game 6 would have been back at the Garden, which would have been cool, but it would have been on Tuesday night, which would have been death. So thankfully, we avoid that. Wednesday night is the Dynamite post show on YouTube. There will be no SmackDown post show this week. I will be in Chicago for House of Glory. And there is a big WWE title match happening on Friday. So I will save my thoughts on SmackDown for the Sound Off next week. That's how we'll do that. So until then, be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a great rest of your week. Stay cool wherever you are. Had to turn the AC off to record this show, and it's 85 degrees outside. So I am sweating bullets right now. I'm going to get out of here. I will see you back here for 968 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solo Monster sounds off.
Axiom, they threw him a bone a few weeks ago. They were in his home country. He had a really good match in Spain. It's like, I said at the time, I said it's like the old toy that they take off the shelf and they kind of, you know, they blow the dust off. Fucking Toy Story 5 is coming out next week. It's like opening the toy chest. Okay, who do we got in here? Ah, we have Axiom in here. We haven't used Axiom in a while. I forgot I even had him in there. And you pull him out of the toy chest and he's kind of dented and he's all fucked up and stuff. But like, you play with him for a little bit and then you throw him back in there. You close the lid and you don't think of him again for another 9 months. That's Axiom. There's so many people that you can use that analogy for on this show. But that's the case with Axiom, and that's the case with Ray Phoenix.
The Solo Monster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good, the bad, and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solo Monster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solo Monster.
I love you so long.